Hello and welcome to What the Faux Travel Podcast. This is Series 2, Episode 9, and we are talking about Syria with Ahmed Al-Rashid.
Hello, welcome along again for another episode of What the Faux Travel Podcast. Now, before we say hello to our guest, here is a clip of him on the BBC programme Exodus, Our Journey to Europe.
From inside the port? No. I am under one of the lorries, waiting for one of the cars to get in so I can sneak.
So, hello, Ahmed.
Hi there.
I have been trying for the last few minutes to get your name right.
Well, you're not the first one. Many, many people have tried it, and some succeeded, others didn't.
Actually, you did okay, didn't you? Sometimes you got it, and you actually said, wow, that's the first time I've heard my name pronounced correctly in so long.
Yes.
But yes, so you're Ahmed, and you were on this BBC programme, all about Syria and, well, it was all about war and conflict and having to leave your country.
Yes, it was, yes.
So we are going to be talking about that a little bit later, but we also want to talk about Syria as a country and all the positive things about it and all the good things that you can do there, the people and all of that. And we want to get some positivity about Syria out there, because obviously when you look online, there's a lot of stuff about the war that's going on there, which is just, it's obviously terrible stuff and it's affecting loads of people. But we want to inject a bit of happiness in that and talk about positivity.
But before we do, my favourite part of the show, and I always say this, I'm going to read out some shout-outs from people that have got in touch over the last couple of months. So, Ahmed, you're going to see how popular we are. And you're going to be even more famous than when you're on BBC. Okay? Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. I don't think so.
Okay, so Nomad Pizza Dad got in touch on Instagram. He said, What the Faux Podcast and a beautiful Indonesian countryside makes a 10-hour train ride very enjoyable. And he actually sent us a picture of him chilled out on the train in Indonesia. Such a cool post. So thanks for getting in touch. Glad you like the show.
Thank you.
And My Travel Mission on Twitter said, really cool podcast all about Romania. That was an episode a couple of months ago. He said, now I'm even more excited about returning on Monday. I said he, it might be a she, I'm not sure. And Mark Della Ventura, he got in touch on Instagram. This is the guy famous from the Budgeteers episode who done the cheese and onion crisp game.
Oh, amazing.
So Mark got in touch. He said, just listen to your first episode. Excited to hear all the others. Thank you very much, Mark, for listening. And David, I think that's David spelt in the Welsh way. David Williams said on Instagram, just how I listened to What the Faux for the first time. Looks like I've got a heap to go through. Thank you, David. And finally, Patrick Hart said on Instagram, well-deserved getting on the front page of iTunes, which we were a couple of months ago. Well-deserved. Love the podcast. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you to everyone that's been getting in touch. It really does make making the podcast a lot easier for us. And yeah, it spurs us on. So thank you very much. So Ahmed, we play a game called The Capitals Game, right? And it sets up our guests ready for the show. Okay, so how are you with your geography around the world?
I think I'm very good with the Middle East, I think. I'm not sure about other parts of the world. And probably because I walked many, many countries in the last 2 years making my journey, I could be good with Europe, probably.
You could. You could, like, hit the top list. You might you might win this game out of all of our guests that we've had on. So what happens is I will give you a series of countries, and you just have to give me the capital city of those countries, okay? And you have to do as many as you can in 30 seconds.
Okay, 30 seconds.
Okay.
Great.
Are you ready?
I am ready, yes.
Okay. Afghanistan.
Kabul.
Belgium.
Brussels.
Egypt.
Cairo.
Estonia.
No idea.
England.
London.
Guatemala.
No clue.
Iran.
Tehran.
Ireland.
Dublin.
South Korea.
Seoul.
Philippines.
No idea. Can't remember.
Germany.
Berlin.
China.
Ooh, Beijing.
Time is up.
I'm sorry, I think you just missed Beijing. Time was up. Am I being harsh?
I think
rules,
the time was out.
Rules are rules.
Rules are rules, yes.
Right, let's go through and see how many you got right.
Okay, so Afghanistan, you got it right. Kabul. Belgium, Brussels, you got that right. Egypt, Cairo, you got that right. Estonia, it's Tallinn. You got that wrong. England, yes, it's London. Guatemala is Guatemala City. Iran, Tehran. You got that right. Ireland, Dublin. You got that right. South Korea, Seoul. You got that right. Philippines is Manila. You got that wrong. Germany, Berlin, correct. And then out of time for China. But you did get it right, which means you got 8 correct, which that's really high up on our leaderboard.
That's really high. I think that means you're third.
Cool.
Yeah, that's really good.
Top three. I'm happy.
So you're good under pressure then, with the music and everything that's going on. You're good under pressure. Right, so Nick, it has now come to the time that you need to do your game show facts for Syria.
So this is the part of the show where we learn a little bit about the country we're about to talk about. And I'm going to read out some facts that I found online. Hopefully I got them from a website which has got true facts, but it's sometimes a bit dodgy.
After you'll tell us that he's got them all wrong, but it's fine. We will learn what's the right thing.
Hit that beat. Syria, officially known as Syrian Arab Republic, is a country in Western Asia bordering Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, and Israel. Syria's capital and largest city is Damascus, and there are claims that it is the oldest continuously occupied city in the world. A country of fertile plains, high mountains, and deserts, it's home to many diverse ethnic and religious groups, including Kurds, Armenians, Christians, Druze, Alawite Shia, Assyrians, and Arab Sunnis. Modern Syria gained its independence from France in 1946, but has lived through periods of political instability driven by the conflicting interests of these various groups. The currency is the Syrian pound. Archaeological evidence shows that Syrians have been drinking beer since at least 2500 BC. The Shouting Valley is the meeting point of four countries, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, and is an echo point, and people often use it to communicate with their relatives on the other side. Syria has won 1 gold, 1 silver, and 1 bronze medal in the history of the Olympics. Syria invented glassblowing. Apple founder Steve Jobs is half Syrian. His biological father was from Syria.
That's amazing. I did not know he was Syrian. And the other one that I found quite interesting was glass blowing. Very nice facts. Well done, Nick.
Thank you.
Amazing. So earlier, like I said, this is What the Faux Travel Podcast. We love to talk about the positivity of a country and we want to know all the good stuff. And this, we want to say now, this is not the place you come for political knowledge, because that's not our forte and that's not what we would like to discuss on this particular podcast. So we want to talk about the culture, the food, the people, all of those really great things, which we will talk about. But first, we would love to hear your personal story of how you arrived in the UK. So so can you tell us briefly what your journey sort of looked like?
Yes, it was a very, very long and pleasant journey, I would say. It all started me leaving Aleppo in late 2012 after the bombardment and the shelling started happening in my place. I left Aleppo to northern Iraq. I moved to the Kurdistan region of Iraq. I was working there. Then the trouble started in Iraq as well. The city of Mosul fell for the Islamic State. And I fled to Turkey, southeast of Turkey. From there, I went to Western Turkey, I went to Izmir city, and there I met a smuggler who helped me and other friends of mine. You know, we met him and he said it will be a yacht. He showed us the picture of a yacht. You know, it's like a 5-star yacht. It will be like 30 minutes. You will get, you know, to Greece. And it turned out to be like, it's not a yacht. It was a dinghy, and it was 88 people on a rubber dinghy. You know, it was plastic rubber dinghy. It was 88 people. It was already leaking before we set off, you know, in the middle of the night. We all crammed into that dinghy. And we were so lucky because literally, like, before it went completely down, we ended up in Kos Island in Greece. And I got a piece of paper which allowed me to take a ferry to Athens, in mainland Athens. Spent a few days there, was trying to find the smugglers. And I found a lot of people trying to go to social media. There was one of these people, you know, one of these groups. They were very active on Facebook. So they set up these Facebook groups, you know, closed groups. And they post everything about the journeys and the prices. So I contacted one of these guys, you know, and he was really angry because like it doesn't work like this. He said, I told him, well, did I do something wrong? He said, no, you need to book an appointment to come and meet me. And again, you go to this Facebook, you know, and they post everything like the dates and the prices and the kinds of passports. And at the end of the post, they write like, if you're a Syrian, you get 20 or 30% discount, you know. And
so they sort of advertise it as a holiday. Yes,
it is a holiday for them. Yeah. Like they're doing a proper job. Like, you know, you've got discounts. And if you got like, if you bring me 2 or 3 clients, you'll get discount and stuff like that. And I remember, like, I walked to the guy's place. You know, I had to book an appointment. When my turn came, I mean, the day came, I walked to his place. It was like a huge pub. At the backyard, there was a small office. There were dozens of people queuing to meet him, you know. When my turn came, I walked into the office, and he came with a suitcase full of passports, American, British, Indian, French passports. And he asked me, do you speak any French? I said, no. He said, do you speak any Spanish? I said, I do not speak any Spanish. And he was angry. And he was yelling at me. He said, what on earth do you speak? I said, well, I speak Arabic. I speak Kurdish. I speak a little bit English. And I said, okay, English would work. So that guy was super intelligent. He drew Athens International Airport map in front of my eyes, you know. And he said, you enter from here. You go through this gate, you scan your boarding. Before you board, there are 2 girls. One is black, one is blonde. You go to the blonde. If you go to the black, we'll lose it all. And I walked, you know, I changed my clothes and I walked inside the airport. And it was a terrifying experience because everything was illegal. I'm illegal, my passport is illegal, my ID is illegal for the first time in my entire life inside, you know, a European airport with everything fake. I was waiting for my flight. My flight was to Marseille because I couldn't afford it to the UK. It would cost me about 10,000 euros. So he said, I'll get you half price to France. My ticket was to Marseille. I was waiting with these French holidaymakers going back home. And suddenly one of these police officers, you know, the control came from behind and told me, show me your passport. And I was really, really scared. I was terrified because I didn't know what to do, you know. And I gave him my passport, I gave him my ID, and I gave him my ticket. And he started looking and he asked me, okay, Mr. Kadyrov Mohammadov, this was the name of the fake passport. Where are you going? I said, well, I just came up with a story. I said, well, I have got my girlfriend in Marseille. We are celebrating our, you know, anniversary together. Is there any problem, sir? You know, he looked at the passport. He looked at it and said, no. Good luck. Go ahead and enjoy.
Really?
I didn't believe it. I boarded and the first thing I did...
So the smuggler didn't tell you to come up with a pre-planned story?
No.
You just came up with that on the spot?
Yes. And I boarded and the first thing I did, I ran to the toilet and I destroyed my passport because the smuggler told me, once you're on board, you know, you destroy your passport. Because if you end up in France and the French control, you know, the border control, border, you know, a police catch you, then you'll be fingerprinted, arrested. The money is gone. The passport is gone. Everything is gone. You'll be deported back to Greece. Everything will be gone for you. I destroyed my passport. And to my surprise, after 2.5 hours, I was literally inside Marseille's airport, you know, in the street with no border control because it was inside the Schengen area. And I said, why I destroyed my passport? I could use it again to fly to the UK. It was too late. Yeah, then from there on a train to Paris, spent about two days in, you know, in Paris, enjoying Paris, enjoying every single, you know.
Did you go to all the sites there?
Yes, I went to the Louvre. I went to the Eiffel Tower. I went to the restaurants. I went to museums. You know, I enjoyed it. After 2 days, I went to Calais. I spent terrible two weeks in Calais. Were worst days of my entire experience, you know, my journey. Every day I was jumping off cars, chasing cars, jumping off the fences. Smugglers putting me and other people in the back of lorries and trucks, freezing freezers with food and chicken. And the last night in Cali, a smuggler from Egypt, he put me and other 7 people in a tanker full of bread flour. And I still remember, you know, the color of that tanker. It was all black, you know. And he said, 2 hours, you'll be in London. And we had to slip through the hole, you know, at the top of the tanker. And when we all 7 people, one of us was a little child, you know, we all were literally like singing in you know, singing in flower, bread flower. And the smuggler, he walked away. When he walked away, you know, he closed, he shut the door of that, of the hull of that tanker. Total darkness. All we could breathe was this flower, you know, dust. No air, no, total darkness. I turned on my GPS. I said, there was no signal, no way to contact or message him. And I told the guys, look, guys, we're going to die here. We're going to suffocate. They told me, shut up, you're a coward. I said, look, I am not a coward. I survived horrendous situations in Syria and Iraq, ISIS, bombing and shelling. I'm not a coward, but just use your logic, use your mind. We are going to suffocate. We're going to die. They told me, shut up. I said, okay, I'm going to shut up. After like, supposed to be 2 hours, and we'll be in London. After like 5 hours, the tanker did not move. After 5 hours, started moving. After like 11 hours, we all started suffocating. We literally like started knocking and knocking. The child with us, you know, he lost conscious, and he fell into this flower, and we had to lift him up. After like 11 hours, we started knocking and knocking and crying, and it was crazy. The driver stopped, and he let us out of that tanker, you know. And we literally near the Italian border. It was not even heading to the UK. It was the wrong car, the wrong driver, the wrong destination, the wrong everything, you know.
Yeah, but after all that, you're going the wrong way. And is that because the smuggler, did he make a mistake or did he lie to you?
I really can't tell. But I think he's a criminal. I do not know what his motives were. But he didn't care at the first place because these people are criminals. They just put you in the back of a car and they say, okay, go. If it works, then they're like, if not, then okay, well, let's try it again. It's just a gamble, and they're just gambling. Yeah.
How do you feel about smugglers? Because, yeah, on the one hand, they may be the reason why you're here today, but on the other hand, yeah, they're criminals and they want to make money.
Well, look, I think here there are like two arguments. Many people throughout my journey, many of the people I've met, saw these smugglers as heroes, real, real heroes, because many of these people, you know, after surviving horrendous situations, so they lost hope in the international community. They lost hope in the UN, in the nation states. They lost hope in the borders, in everything, you know. And if you're in a desperate situation, you know, absolutely, after losing everything and someone shows up and says, well, look, I can get you to France and all you have to do is just trust me. That guy would be an angel for you, for a lot of people. And on the other hand, you know, most of the people and most of these people, you know, criminals, absolutely criminals, because they exploited these people's situation because they knew they are going through a very difficult situation, you know, and they took advantage of their situation to make a lot of money. And I was reading a report, I think it was last year, and a research by the University of Oxford. In 2015, in Turkey alone, smugglers generated over 500 million euros. This is only in Turkey.
That's insane, yeah.
Absolutely insane. And the problem is there's no way to counter it because a lot of these people see these smugglers as their saviors. And the problem is this business is flourishing. I mean, they're using technology, they're using a lot of resources. And I'll tell you a story, and this is really an incredible, incredible story. When I was in Calais, then I moved to Dunkirk in France. There's one guy, Iraqi Kurd, who was about 14-something. That guy was super intelligent. He was like a tech geek, you know. He had a small laptop where he would go online, you know, and he would hack into the website of one of the shipping companies. And we'd go inside and we'd see what times the lorries or the tank, these trucks are leaving. He would get into like the personal details of the drivers. He would know, where are they from? The family names or their mobile numbers or the emails. And we'd ask them, look, we got people here and you would help us get them in. You know, if these drivers refuse, it was, well, I've got all your details. So
yeah, they can really, sort of drop family names,
yes,
can't they? Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I found them, they are criminals. But sometimes if you're in a desperate situation, these criminals become your savior.
The smugglers that you actually personally met and they got you through certain borders, how do you feel about those particular people? Like your interactions with them, what do you think of them as a person?
I mean, I've got different feelings. Some of them I met were really, really generous. They were very supportive. I mean, I remember when I crossed from Syria into Turkey, swimming in the mid of night, you know, it's a rainy night, swimming like the Tigris River. the guy was incredible. He was a young man, about 17, 18 years old. You know, he was swimming and like he was helping everyone. And he was doing it from his heart because, look, I want to help my people. And he didn't charge a lot of money, you know. And I found him, he was a great guy. But the ones I met in Greece, for example, with some Syrians, Iraqis, Sudanese and Afghanis, were absolutely criminals. All they cared about was money. They were all armed, you know, with knives and weapons and pistols, and some of them were with Kalashnikovs. And I remember in one incident, it was an Iraqi guy, an Iraqi family, the father, a mother and two little children. And there was an argument between the smugglers and the Iraqi guy. The Iraqi guy, look, I'm going to call the police. And we were about 88 people, you know, before we got into that dinghy. And these four smugglers with knives, you know, and weapons, and Kalashnikovs, they started beating the man. He was bleeding. They beaten his wife. The kids were terrified. You know? And for us, when we saw this, we're terrified. We did not dare to say no. They all, you know, forced us into this dinghy, which was already leaking before we sat off. We didn't dare to say yes or no.
What was it like being in that dinghy?
Gosh, that was the worst, probably one of the worst experiences of my entire life, because in a rubber dinghy, you know, 88 souls, half of them women and children, in the middle of the night, absolutely nowhere. Everything is sea. You are surrounded by the sea. I mean, the dinghy was leaking. With 88 people on a rubber dinghy, if two or three people started moving, then you lose control, you lose balance and it capsizes, you know, and it will be a disaster. You know, for me, like seeing many of these women and children crying, you know, crying, literally crying, and not being able to do anything for them was heartbreaking. And I said, look, to myself, I'm a good swimmer. I said, look, if this thing goes down, probably I can help one, maximum two. Was for me like this idea, like imagining if the dinghy goes down and seeing children and women and men drowning in front of my eyes was like beyond imagination. Then I went back to Calais, and from Calais I went to Germany, met my brother for the first time in 5 years, almost 5 years. He crossed from Libya, fled Syria to Libya. From Libya he crossed the Mediterranean to Italy. Then he ended up in Germany because the situation in Libya was terrible, terrible.
How was it seeing your brother for the first time?
I remember when I saw him after 5 years, when he left Syria, it was like little. He was like 13 something.
Oh wow, he's that young.
Yes. And when I saw him, he was about 18 something. Was like, when he left, he was a kid.
A boy.
When I saw him, oh god, he's, you know, taller than me, he's bigger than me.
Wow.
You know, I was really surprised. And we spent a few days together, and he said, look, you're more than welcome to stay here, but look, you've got a family still in Aleppo, and if you stay here, it'll take us ages to get our family out of Aleppo. Try to make it to the UK. I met another smuggler. He put me in another lorry. Spent about 3 nights in that lorry, day and night. We had food and some water with us, you know, and some free bags, you know, sacks. And we were lucky, after like 3 nights in the back of that lorry, we ended up in Hull, you know, in the UK.
How did you know for the first time? It was your phone, wasn't it, that told you?
Yes, I turned on my mobile, and the first message I got from a mobile service provider was, welcome to the UK, this is blah 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 network. You know, I knew that I'm in the UK, and it was already raining inside there, so I knew that it's the UK.
After almost 2 months from leaving Syria, now I'm in the UK. Now my dream is coming true. So glad, so happy that I've made it.
Can you even begin to explain that feeling to us? How did you feel when you arrived in the UK?
I was very glad. I was very, very happy because, again, my story is a success story, is a hope story. Despite all the horrors and all the awful stuff, mine is a success. When I arrived, I was so grateful because I have many, many friends who lost their lives while trying to move out of Syria. They were shot at the borders, or they lost lives in the sea. You know, I've never seen them, or there's nothing recovered from their bodies. So I knew that I am a lucky person. Mine is a success story, that I'll get the chance, hopefully, to start a new life, get a new life for my family. So mine is a success story, and I was very happy, yeah.
So moving on to a time that was a lot happier.
Today, the 10th of October, 2015, I've just got this post. It will be the decision on my
asylum. I've been granted asylum in the UK. Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed.
So how do you feel listening to that? Like, how did you feel at that moment where you'd been granted asylum?
It was a great, great moment for me, because that meant that I am legally here in this country, that I am not illegal. You know, this illegal brand does not apply to me anymore, that I am a human, that I'm a person. That means that I can get my family out of Syria safely. And that's why I made it all the way to this country.
And how long had it been since you last saw your family?
Over a year and a half.
And your youngest daughter, you hadn't even met her yet?
No, we did not meet.
Wow.
Yeah, I just became a father, like, of a ready-made family, and go deal with it. You know, a lot of work to do and a lot of things to learn.
So in the programme that the BBC made of you, you actually saw on the programme you meeting your family at the airport, and it was such an emotional bit of TV. It was amazing. I can't even imagine how that felt for you.
That moment was, I think, probably one of the most incredible, most important moments of my entire life. Because when I left Syria to Iraq, you know, I knew we were separated because the town was divided. So I was separated from my family. You know, they couldn't get to me. And the moment when I saw my family at Heathrow Airport, you know, when I touched them, I knew that they're alive, you know, that we are going to sleep tonight, not worrying that our house is going to be bombed, or my children are going to be killed or beheaded. I was so happy. It was the greatest moment, and I feel like we're all reborn again.
Yeah, and because, you know, you've done that whole journey for your family, and anyone who's a good father or a good mother, they'd do the same thing. Because if you're living somewhere where it's horrible, and if someone says, if you make this dangerous journey, but there's the chance you and your family can have a happy life, then you're going to do it, aren't you? So the whole journey was for your family. And then that moment where you saw them, yeah, on the TV, it was quite emotional to watch, wasn't it? It was really
powerful.
It
was very emotional. And obviously, they're not even my family, and I was crying watching it.
We're going to talk about Syria. And like we said earlier, we want to focus on, you know, the many amazing things about the country. Let's go back when, you know, it was fine for tourists to visit Syria. What would have been, like, the thing to do? Like, you come to London, you see Big Ben, Buckingham Palace. So, yeah, tell us about some of the really cool things that you could have seen in Syria.
I think the amazing thing about Syria is it really has a lot of wonderful stuff. I mean, it has very, very beautiful beaches on the Mediterranean. You know, you could go to Latakia and you could go to Tartus and all these two cities, you know, they're coastal cities. There are many, many people who go and visit there during the summer. The beaches are really, really sand beaches. They are wonderful. And if you like history, you can visit a lot of places. I mean, Palmyra is a great, great city. I mean, you can go there, you see the ruins, you can see the history. You can go to Aleppo. Aleppo, you know, the old city of Aleppo. Aleppo Citadel is hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, you go see the old, old churches in Aleppo. You can go see the old mosques, you know, and even like the synagogues, you know, abandoned synagogues. If you like food, you can go to you know, for example, to Homs, or, I mean, all over the country, you know, really, I mean, there's so many restaurants. The food is really amazing.
Well, yeah, so you're talking about the food. Tell us more. So what's a traditional Syrian meal?
Ah, this is a very tough question. And I think there's nothing called tradition, I think, but it's so much diverse, you know. Again, it depends which part of the country you're coming from. If you're coming from the north, or if you're coming from the east, or if you're from the central, the eastern part of the country, you know, like, for example, in a place like Aleppo, you know, every Friday, it's kind of, you know, like, it's a ritual. Every Friday, most of the people of Aleppo, you know, in the suburbs and the countryside, every Friday, they would sit together, you know, and they would go for this called Fulham Dammas, which is beans, you know, and they make it like, with the sauce. It's very, very special. And every member of the family should be present on that Friday. And they do it, you know. And this hummus. The hummus and this Fulham Dammas, which is the beans. And you got this salad. It's just, you know, so, so delicious. And it's kind of, you can see, like, it's, you're not even in Aleppo. You're going to go to Damascus. Sabaha, you know. It's like every Friday, so it became national. Every family in that country sit together, every member. And you cannot say that, oh no, I cannot make it. Everyone should be there.
Yeah.
And it's a great thing because every Friday you get the families all together, coming together, families and friends and enjoying food. And it's incredible.
So it's a vegetarian meal then? Is that?
It is totally vegetarian.
Is that really common? Do you not really eat meat in Syria?
No, really. I mean, we do eat meat. But I think at that time, if you're coming from a working class, it's really expensive at that time.
Okay.
It's not expensive, but it's a bit expensive. You're working. It's not easy. I mean, meat at that time was not cheap. And a lot of people prefer because we used to grow a lot of like tomato, potato, you know, a lot of vegetables. So we had it available, you know, and yeah, we used a lot of vegetables when cooking.
Now, we'll go back to the big feast you were talking about where like the community comes together. If at that time, if some visitors, like let's say me and Amy, were there in the town at that time, would it be okay for like tourists to like join in with the community to get it, or would it be strange? Would people not be used to seeing tourists?
Well, I think it depends really. I mean, there are many places who are used to have many tourists. So and these people are open, they're welcome, and it's fine for you to go and share a meal with them and even sleep. If you go like in further places where there are new tourists in a small village, people will find it very strange. But yet, I remember like in 2000, I think it was 9 or 10 in my village, there were like a group of people from Korea and I think Japan, you know, they were touring in my area. And they kind of lost their way. They didn't know what to do. And they ended up in my town, you know. Oh, come on, guys. So the entire village came to welcome them. It was a small village. Everyone came and
amazing.
Welcomed them. And I remember, like, my friend had a small camera. Everyone wanted to take a picture of this. Because for most of these people, it was the first time they saw a Japanese person. You know, it was unbelievable. So food, and it was really incredible. It was a great experience.
Great. I mean, our experience of countries in the Arabic world is just great hospitality. Like, yeah, that's so, so welcoming. Like,
I think, yes.
It seems like a big part of, like, Arabic life.
I think it's really a big, big part of the Arab identity. This idea of being welcoming and being hospitable. There's like, for example, there are many, many proverbs in Arabic, you know, which shows that you need to be generous, you know, that you need to respect strangers and be open and offer them whatever you could.
That's incredible. Looking more at the terrain of Syria, and I know, Nick, you mentioned it a little bit in your game show Facts, that it's quite mountainous.
Yeah, there's mountains and deserts. There's all sorts, really.
Because, for example, when I talk to people about Afghanistan, they're quite surprised when I say that you can ski there. So in terms of the terrain of Syria, can you go on hikes? Can you really get out in the wilderness? Like or is it mainly cities and villages?
Well, I think it's the terrain there is diverse, mountains, you know, beaches, even deserts. So you can go climb mountains and like, I don't know, see the top of like Jabal or Mount Sheikh, you know, Qasyun, which is like a mountain which shows you beneath it, you know, you can see the entire city of Damascus, for example. You go to places like in up west of the country, we see a lot of forests, a lot of woods, you know, like in places like Kasab, you know, and Slumfi. And if you want to go like to the deserts and you go like to Raqqa or go, you know, eastern or to Deir ez-Zor, and there's like the river, like the Euphrates River, you know, and the Tigris River. So I think it really has everything there.
I was going to say, a bit of everything. Mountains, desert, rivers. Like, that can accommodate so many different things, whether you like hiking or,
yes,
I don't know, canoeing maybe. Yeah. So it seems like it's got everything.
If you just like cities and, yeah, eating local food, yeah, there's a lot you can do there. Sounds great.
Absolutely. I'd quite like to know, what's life like for a Syrian woman? So can Syrian women drive? Can they vote? Like, and I know that might sound like a stupid question to you, but from our point of view, being here, that's not sort of something that we would know. What was life like for a woman?
Well, I think before the conflict was really, I mean, women used to be partners and everything, and they had a leading role in the society. Women drive, women are teachers, women are doctors, women are MPs, you know, and women are poets, writers, presenters. They are all over the place, and they make a huge contribution. I mean, talking of my village and the place where I'm coming from, women take the lead, because I think this is the case of Syria and I think other parts of the Middle East, because these people, I mean, the women, you know, are responsible of looking after the children, looking after their homes, and I guess sometimes helping, you know, in their field, their husbands. So I think their role is really, really essential, as they're doing a great job. And I think, again, I mean, this is what I like about Syria, you know, like, many of these women have taken like leadership positions, and men are open about it, you know. And there was never, I think, well, not never, but it was the discrimination. Like, if you compare to other parts of the Arab region, the women in Syria were open. She could travel anywhere, you know, without needing a brother or a father with her. Or she, it was not a big deal for her to drive. It was easy. I mean, she could drive. She could go to the university. Travel abroad for studying or work. Yep.
That's really good. That's really nice to hear, because from our culture, and we've said that, like, you know, the news, they're not really saying great things about Syria because of what's going on there. And that's why we wanted to talk about this. We want to know, what is it like for a woman and all of that?
That's really good to hear. Now, this is going to be a difficult question. I suppose no one knows the answer, but what do you think the future holds for, I mean, we're a travel show, so what do you think the future holds for tourism one day, you know, in the country? Or it might be a stupid question, is there anywhere tourists can go now? Is there a slight part which is okay? You know, yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, I think now the situation is really difficult. It's very hard to tell what's going to happen. But again, I think we need to focus on the narrative of hope. I mean, if you see Germany after World War II, you know, it was totally destroyed. Many parts of Europe were totally destroyed. And I think, and this is the credit should be given to the Syrian people, they're very hardworking, intelligent, smart people. But now they're going, you know, through a very terrible time experience. But I think hopefully when this overcome, I mean, this conflict, this war comes to an end, I think Syria will be rebuilt. I think it will be, again, a great, great destination where you can go, you know, skiing, you can go swimming, canoeing, you know, seeing sightseeing. You can go enjoy the food, enjoy the history, enjoy the coexistence of people, the language, the culture, the music, you know, the hospitality. And I'm hopeful. And I think so much. But I think with the help of friends, we can stand up again and rebuild it. And I think, again, Syria would be a place, as it always used to be, a place of welcoming for all and everyone.
Well, when that day does come, and it will come, we want to go to Syria, and hopefully you can show us your hometown. You can be like our tour guide in Syria. That would be amazing. I'd love to go.
Yeah, same. I've got a bucket list. I think I'm actually going to put it on my bucket list, that I'd love to go to Syria.
Definitely. You are more than welcome.
Cool. So we're going to play a game. And then when we come back, I just want to briefly talk to you about what your life's been like in England and just how you and your family have got on here. But the game that we are playing is called Are You Serious?
It's a clever name, isn't
it? Bit of
a
play on words there. So, Nick, do you want to explain what we're doing in this game?
Yeah, so the game Are You Serious? I'm going to read out, it's Amy versus Ahmad, and I'm going to read out some headlines, some news stories, okay? And you've got to work out whether you think they're fake stories or if they're real stories. If they're fake, you say to me, are you serious? Or if they're real, just say, yeah, I think that's true, okay? Simple game. What I'll do, I'll read out the headline, then I'll ask you, take it in turns, and then I'll keep score. Okay, here we go. Okay, Ahmad, you can answer the first one. So, rare rhino goes on Tinder to highlight extinction crisis. So a rhino on a dating website. Do you think that's a true story or are you serious?
Are you serious?
So you think it's fake, Amy?
So wait, if I think it's fake, I say, are you serious? Okay, I'm going to say the same. Are you serious?
I am totally serious. It is a true story. What? I heard it on the radio the other day. There's a rare rhino, and his zookeepers have made him a dating profile to hide, you know, just to get some publicity because they need to find a mate. But otherwise, the rhino will go extinct.
That's actually hilarious.
True story. So you're both wrong so far.
Okay.
Next one. Friends take random Joe on holiday to Spain after mate with the same name pulls out. Think that's true or false?
I'm going to say I think that's true because I've heard of stories like this before, and they can't change the name of the ticket, the plane ticket, so they get someone with the same name. So I think that's true.
A complete stranger to come on holiday with them.
Yeah, I would go for the same as well. Yes.
You both think it's true. You're both correct. So again, I am being serious. Yeah, that was absolutely true. I think there's been a few of these stories happen in the news, but that is a true story. Next one. Woman arrested for defecating, for pooing, on boss's desk after winning the lottery. Now, these are all real. Like, they were headlines in newspapers, but were they fake or were they true? So a woman takes her shit on her boss's desk after she won the lottery. Ahmad, am I being serious?
Well, maybe yes.
You think it's true?
Maybe.
Okay.
I think this is true, but I'm going to say, are you serious? Just so we've got different answers.
So you think it's fake?
Yeah.
Amy, you are correct.
Oh.
I'm not being serious. It's a fake story.
Oh, I thought that would be true, because like some people, if they'd won the lottery, they'd kind of want to say up you to their boss, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Okay, next one. Man becomes hero to cats in war-torn Syria. Okay, so a man is a hero.
Yes, I know.
Don't give it. Amy will say the same thing now. So you think I am being serious? You think it's true?
Well, he's already said it's true. So.
I think it's true. And the story happened in Aleppo, and I know the guy who took the pictures of it. So
really? Would you tell us the story?
That part of Aleppo, you know, was bombed, and a lot of people left. And there were a lot of cats left, you know. And that guy, you know, had to go every day. He was a fighter, you know. Go collect food and meat for these cats, and he just go and feed them all.
Aww. That's true, yeah. Every morning since the war started in 2011, Mohammed Ala Al-Jali, he buys meat from the butchers in Aleppo so he can feed 150 of the local stray cats. True story.
Very nice.
So,
good man.
Next, a can of squirty cream explodes inside man's butt during a shoplifting incident. So a man tries to steal some cream, it explodes inside him.
I'm going to say, are you serious?
Are you serious?
Yes.
So you think it's fake? Correct. It is a fake story. I am not serious.
So you didn't make these up? These were actually on the internet?
These are real headlines, yeah.
Right.
But just some are true and some are not true. Okay, next. Muddy jeans for men on sale for £330. Am I being serious or not?
What, so they've just got mud on them?
Yeah, yep. I think you sometimes get crazy stuff like that.
Crazy fashion things.
Yes.
Do you think it's true?
Yes.
Okay, just to be different, I'll just say, are you serious?
Okay. Ahmad, it is true. I am being serious. So, Amy, you lose that one. Woman stabbed her husband to death because he wouldn't eat her ass.
Why have you put loads of gross ones on here, Nick?
It's a real headline.
I'd say it's true.
You think true?
I would say no, this is fake.
Am I serious?
Am I serious?
It is a fake story, so Ahmad, you are correct.
Oh, you keep winning it.
Okay, next. Women keep giving birth after eating this legendary pizza. It's called the Inducer. Buffalo chicken wing. True or false? So women keep giving birth after they eat this spicy pizza.
I'm going to say that's true because, well, I've heard that spicy food induces a pregnancy. Or a birth. So I reckon it's true.
I would say the same because this is something very familiar and serious.
Yeah. And you're both correct. It is absolutely right.
What, the pizza is or just spicy
food? It's the pizza or the spicy food. You know, yes.
Okay.
Okay. And finally, man ran into ocean to avoid £375 restaurant bill. True or false? Am I being serious?
Are you serious?
Do you think it's fake?
I love how you're saying it. Are you serious? I'm going to say it's true.
You say true. Sorry, Amy, you are correct. It is true. But that means at the end, it's a draw. 6-6.
Oh, man. Draw. Wow. Cool. Well done to us, Ahmed.
But good story, yeah, about the man who's a hero to cats.
There were some weird ones in there, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, well, I wanted to find the most like bizarre, strange stories out there. But there we go. Are you serious?
Can we just hear you say, are you serious, one more time?
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's good.
I think I might just turn that into a jingle. That's a better jingle.
Are you serious?
Right, okay. So just before we finish up, I would like to know, have you been welcomed into our country in the UK? And you can be honest with us. Has it been an okay place or a nice place or a bad place to live?
It's been almost 2 years since I arrived in the UK. And I would say my experience, and again, this is my personal experience. I'm not speaking on behalf of other people who made it to this country to seek asylum. Mine has been a great success story. And I remember after I got my refugee status, a few days later, I was asked to move out of the property which the Home Office supported me to stay. I didn't have a place. I didn't have a penny. I didn't have a financial record in this country. I didn't have a national insurance number. I was literally like threatened to be, you know, homeless. And I posted something on Facebook. And this group, you know, in Surrey, in Epsom, contacted me. They said, come and live with us. And I moved. I didn't know these people, you know. And it was a great experience. I lived for them for about 5 months, you know, sharing a great house with them. And they introduced.
They
were both English, but they were, I think one of them, they were descendant from a person. The parents fled Europe during the Nazis, so they're descended from refugees who came to this country. There was a great experience, about 5 months living with them. And they had like a private small jet. So from time to time, they flew me over London. You know, it was a great experience.
This is incredible.
Wow, you hit the jackpot.
It was really great. And they introduced me to new people. And through these people, I was able to apply for scholarships. And I managed to secure a scholarship. And now I'm doing my master's at SAWAS, the University of London.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Thanks so much. So for me, it was great. I've met the most fantastic people here. I've met many, many, many friends. The people are really friendly. They are supportive. They're welcoming. And I really look forward to that day that the conflict would come to an end. So I would welcome as many as of them back to Syria.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's incredible. So when you were living with that couple, was that on your own or was that when your family had arrived?
No, I was by my own. And when my family arrived, I had to find another property. And this way, another great, great family came. They were a landlord, you know, and they said, look, I know that you don't have a place. I'm a landlord. I'll give you this property for free till you're on your feet. I was within 24 hours, fully furnished, you know, even with food in the fridge, you know, I didn't have a penny and they didn't pay a penny. And they said, okay, when you're on feet, you pay us. You know, you pay us back. And it was a great experience for me.
I'm so glad you had a good experience. I know there will be people out there that haven't in the UK, but that is actually made me really proud to be English and that there's another fellow English person that would have done that. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, that is incredible. It's great. If anyone's listening now, like what, if anything, what can people do if they want to help?
I think there are many ways if you're here in this country. I mean, first of all, you just have some empathy and understand that no one wants to leave his home, his country, his history, his loved one and put his life in the back of a lorry, in a tanker or in the middle of the sea. No one would do it unless Syria was the last resort for them, you know. And once these people here, a lot of these people want to be friendly. You know, just talk to these people. The least these people could do is put a smile on your face, you know. A lot of these people want, for example, if you got like a spare room, you could talk to people like at refugees at home. These people so far helped over 20,000, you know, nights.
Sorry, that was refugees at home.
Refugees at home. These are the group that helped me, you know, the family. Then they set up this charity. And you can help these people, like befriending them, you know, talk to them or some of these people want to learn like basic IT skills. If you got your skills, you can help them. If you got free time or you are an expert in some area and you find some people are interested, you can help them. You know, you can volunteer with a lot of organizations. Or if you got any spare laptop or a spare phone or a spare whatever, you know, you can give this to people. I think they're really, I mean, some of these people like would need, for example, to apply for university. So they need to write a personal statement. They want someone in English to proofread it for them, for example. You could do a lot, man. You can really could do a lot.
That sounds amazing. And that's really inspiring to know that you can do that, actually. I think when we finish this, I'm going to look up a few things that I could do. Look at them charities and start working with people that are close to me in Essex.
Yeah, and that's it. A lot of people, like, they might see the news and think, oh, this is terrible, what's happening? But a lot of people don't really know what to do. I know with the internet now, it won't take long to Google and have a look. But yeah, people need to know what they can do to help. And so that's really good.
Absolutely. Well, I certainly feel like I have learned a lot today. So thank you so much for talking to us. Is there anything that you would like to promote? Anything that you, any work you've got going on or your Twitter or anything like that?
I think you got my Twitter handle, so people are more than welcome, you know, to follow me and I'll follow them back.
Yeah.
And
which
it's at Jack Ahmed, Ahmed 2. So it's Jack Ahmed 2. This is my Twitter handle.
We'll retweet and mention it a lot.
I would say like reach out to people, see if you're interested. You know, if you want, for example, learn a language, if you want to learn Arabic, there's so many people there already to teach you Arabic. If you want to learn, like let's say like Farsi or Turkish, there's so many people out there would give their time. You know, if you need someone to talk to, or if you got, you know, meet new friends or new cultures and new food. So there's all these new initiatives going, like, I'll share my food with you. So this is Syrian food. Tell me, how do you like it? So there's so many stuff going on. Yeah.
Cool. And actually, I've got one more question before we do a wrap up. Again, I know it's very hard to say, but so you hope to go back to Syria one day? Do you see your family living in the UK for much longer? I know no one knows what's going to happen over then, how long it'll be till the war's over, but what would you like to happen in the next 5-10 years?
Oh, well, I mean, always you have hope that you could go back home where your family, where your loved ones, where everything is there. And sometimes it's out of hand, but you always cling to this hope, you know. Hopefully, I mean, I would like to take advantage of my time being in this country. So I'm trying now, I'm almost done with my dissertation for my master's. I might go on a PhD or do some work to help people here. Because I think the UK, England in particular, has got a very special heart, place in my heart, because this place welcomed me, you know, for the last 2 days. It welcomed me. It welcomed my children. It welcomed my family. I want to do something to help here and pay them back. And hopefully one day when the conflict is over, I could go back to help rebuild my country with other people.
Incredible. Thank you so much for talking to us. It's been eye-opening, amazing, and we've learned a lot. And I know a lot of the people that listen to this podcast would have as well. So thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thank you.
Are you serious?
Don't forget, you guys can get in touch with the show. You can send us an email. Our address is whatthefopodcast@gmail.com. Fo is spelled P-H-O. On Twitter, we are @fopodcast. Also, check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. With all this social media, this podcast doesn't just come in your ears. We also come in your eyes. Lads, 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 lads.